Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with co-host Russ Chianelli, and today we're going to be talking about breaking paradigms. We're going to be talking about everything everybody knows and understands, and then somebody comes along and says, I don't quite think that's the truth, and does some beautiful experiments and disproves what everybody had believed before those experiments took place. So, Russ, who's our guest?
We're very happy to have with us this time on Science Studio Professor Bill Evans from the Chemistry Department at the University of California at Irvine. Welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, this is going to be fun. So, but before we get into this paradigm that you sort of shattered, so how did you get into science? What were those formative decision-making periods?
Well, I think probably the most important one was when I started to do undergraduate research in college. Was interested in chemistry from high school, but didn't really know very much about what chemistry was about till my senior year, and I started to do experiments in a laboratory, and that's where I fell in love with the area.
Where was this, and what were the experiments?
So this was at the University of Wisconsin, and I was working in the laboratory to get some credit for my degree, so I was just following the rules. I was on the rowing team, and I had a big time commitment to be on the water in the boat with my colleagues, with my fellow rowers. So I picked the laboratory that required only 10 hours a week of time rather than all the other ones required 12. So it wasn't a very scientific decision in choosing the subject, but that's why I picked this particular lab of Don Gaines, who does boron chemistry. He works with colorless gases that explode, so It's quite an unusual type of introduction to experimental science, but that's what we did. Turns out I fell in love with doing borane chemistry in the lab, and by the end of the year, I was spending about 24 hours a week in the laboratory. I still was rowing, and I'm afraid my girlfriend saw a little less of me because of my interest in science.
And then that girlfriend wasn't your future wife.
She was not, no. Perhaps there's a correlation there.
Did you ever win anything in your rowing career?
I won a bunch of shirts. So traditionally, Rowers exchange shirts. The winner takes the loser's shirt, and I have four or five shirts, I'm proud to say. So,
yes. And what happens to the winner's shirt? He just keeps them?
He keeps them, yes.
That's an interesting. I didn't know that. I mean, you see football players soccer players exchange jerseys.
Yeah.
But I never realized that there was a winner keep all.
Yeah. In college rowing in the U.S., that's a tradition. Yeah.
Lovely. Yeah. Okay. So boron chemistry was the kickoff point.
Yes.
What did you do after that? You went to graduate school, obviously.
Right. So then I was in what I call the boron pipeline because Professor Gaines at Wisconsin introduced me to Professor Hawthorne at UCLA, who was a boron chemist. I did my PhD with Fred Hawthorne, and Fred introduced me to Earl Mutertes, who was a boron chemist at DuPont, who was moving to Cornell, and I did a postdoc at Cornell. So I was in the boron string there for most of my education.
I remember Mutertes when I used to see him, not often, but he was the one person that had the most beautiful tan of any chemist that I ever saw. How did he do that? Because it had to be unnatural.
No, I don't think so. He was a skier, and he liked to fish, and he liked to learn a new word every day. He was quite a Renaissance person, I would say. He was a very good scientist, but he was doing all sorts of things.
And he passed away untimely in Berkeley. If I remember correctly.
He did because he was a smoker and he died of cancer.
Lung cancer, yeah.
That's a sort of brief history of Bill Evans. And, of course, what we're really here to talk about is how you break a preconceived concept. And just to set it up, if those of you know the periodic table, right at the bottom there are a couple of rows called the lanthanides and the actinides. And the lanthanides are actually very valuable materials, and we'll talk about that later in the program.
Good.
But it was universally understood, just as sodium was always supposed to be in the form of plus one, and chlorine is always supposed to be minus one, lanthanide salts were always plus three. And you just destroyed that notion. So tell us, how did you set about doing that? Was it a goal that you suddenly came across, or how did you develop from boron into those heavy elements?
Yeah, well, let me tell you first how I got into the lanthanides. When I was ready to start my own career, I thought I should get out of the boron pipeline and do something different, and I wanted to find something that was completely different. I went to a university where I was told I needed to be the best in the world in my area to get tenure. So I decided to go into a part of the periodic table where there was no one else. And then by definition, I would be the best.
So
it was a bit of a joke.
Here. You go to the lab with 10 hours instead of 12. You've got to be the best at something, so choose an area where no one works.
So it was a bit of a joke, but also I wanted to find some place where very little was being investigated, and that was the lanthanides at the time. So we started to study them when my bosses, Fred Hawthorne and Neuromutates, thought I was crazy. And they used to talk about how they were going to get me my next job because I was working with these lanthanides and there was no chemistry to be discovered there. But they didn't tell me. They let me go ahead and do it.
Because crazy was a plus.
Yes, right. And sometimes you discover some new things. So we explored the lanthanides and we started working with – most of them are plus three, as you say. There were three that you could get that had plus two oxidation states. And we work with those. We work with the most reactive one of those.
And just for our audience, why don't you clarify what plus two means?
So plus two is the charge on the ion. If you take two electrons away from a metal, then you would have a plus two ion.
Right.
That gave us a lot of good chemistry for many years. The breakthrough you're talking about had to do with thulium. So theoretically, people said that thulium was another element that could have a plus two oxidation state. We tried to make it several times without success. And I pretty much assumed that it was too unstable, too reactive to ever be able to isolate. And the way we found it was in a collaboration with a scientist in Russia, Mikhail Bochkarev, contacted me and said he thought he'd made a thulium-2 compound, and I didn't believe that was likely. He said he couldn't crystallize it. He couldn't get the data that he needed to prove it was thulium-2, and I wasn't surprised because I didn't think it existed. And he wanted to collaborate with my lab because we'd had a lot of success in crystallizing materials and getting the X-ray crystallography information that proves what you have. And so I said, just to be a good guy, we'll collaborate with you, but I didn't think anything would come of it. He sent us materials. It didn't diffract the X-rays, so we got no information. I wasn't surprised. We tried to recrystallize his material. It didn't succeed. But we tried one more time. We did a fresh preparation using his synthesis, and much to my amazement, we got a structure which proved we had the first thulium-2 molecule.
That was while you were getting tenure, or did you already
have tenure? I already had tenure.
That leads to a sort of another question is when you take risks, whether you're the assistant professor or the full professor. We'll come back to that.
Okay,
you were surprised, but what was the excitement that generated in you?
Well, I couldn't believe that this was possible, and much of my career up to that time had been based on the samarium plus two. So I had a wonderful career with samarium plus two. Suddenly, I had a whole new element to work with. So I was very excited about that.
Now, you mentioned that the crystal structure proved that it was plus two.
Right.
Since then, are there any spectroscopies that agree with that?
Oh, yes. So the magnetism and the color of the material, everything lined up, and it was clearly plus two. Now, there's an addendum to this. Once we discovered this, Bochkarev and I and our groups tried to get some new chemistry out of thulium-2, and we couldn't do it for the next 3 years. So we had this big discovery, and I was so excited, and then for 3 years we had nothing that came out of this new, and we thought it was just a...
You mean you couldn't make anything else?
Anything useful or interesting. Nothing was coming out. So I had years of experience with samarium plus two and lots of interesting reactions and reactivity and nothing out of this new, more reactive species. And I began to think that maybe samarium plus two was as reactive as you could get, and this thulium-2 structure was just an unusual outlier that we happened to be lucky to find.
I have a question about the lanthanides, which is a little off track, but
okay. You
may know the answer. We run a blog for the Materials Research Society.
Okay.
And one of the topics right now is electric vehicles. But it turns out that for the motors, you have to have lanthanum and rare earths.
Right.
And when you dig into that, you find that that's a big environmental problem, and getting enough of them out of strip mines, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, I think the problem is a matter of supply. So these are iron, neodymium, boron magnets, and they need the neodymium. They're very high power-to-weight ratio, so you get a lot of power without too much weight in your magnet, and they can go into any kind of motor. And there's a little bit of dysprosium that's added to enhance the performance, and dysprosium is actually not very common. And so there's a question of how much of these materials you can get to provide all the motors that we'd like to build. I don't know the issues about strip mining.
The rarity in the United States, for example, there are some strip mines. I don't remember where they are. But the supply is just as you say. It's a question.
Yeah.
Or we have to have a different magnetic material.
Well, in fact, we were talking last night over some drinks about this very issue.
Right.
Are they still really should be called rare earths?
No, in terms
in terms of abundance.
In terms of their abundance in the Earth's crust, right. They're not rare. They're more common than silver or mercury or the precious metals,
right.
Platinum,
palladium. But the supply is not distributed equally.
You were saying
most of it is, I think, in China?
So there's huge deposits in China, and China is the main supplier now, but China is also growing, and they need these for all of the motors that they're building in China. And so we have a mine in the U.S. and California, actually, in the Mojave Desert, quite a good mine, but it shut down many years ago because it wasn't as cost-effective as the mines in China. And so now they'll probably reopen that mine.
Have you seen an increase? I mean, and since the whole concept of batteries and the power-weight ratio business, has the cost of the rare earths, the lanthanides, increased significantly?
Oh, it's been increasing and increasing, and China realizes that this is a valuable material, and they have a lot of it, and so they could price it appropriately so that the market will still buy it. But the prices have been going up. Even the last few weeks, they've gone up a lot.
Is there a particular geologic formation associated? I mean, why just this one particular area? I mean, that sort of geology is all over the place.
Yeah, so that's very strange. So the Mountain Pass mine in California is in one location in the Mojave Desert, and there's mountains all over there, and there's just this one mountain that has enormous amount of lanthanides. So geologically, it makes sense that they all concentrate together because they have similar chemistry. All 14 metals have similar chemistry. So we know why they're all in one spot, but why are they in that one mountain? I don't know.
And you were talking about Thulium. Where does that name come from? Is that a place?
It's from Thule, from Scandinavia.
Right.
So a lot of these were discovered in Scandinavian, and they're named after Scandinavian towns. So Iterby is a town, and Iterbium, and Terbium, and...
And the reason was because they had cheap hydroelectric power, and a lot of these were formed the first time by electrolysis. That's a story I carry around with me. But
that's one I haven't heard.
But it may not be true.
Yeah.
But it might
be. But
they
were called the rare earths because they were discovered late, and so people thought they must be rare. But in fact, they're not really rare.
Well, after your sort of initial surprise and happiness and then three barren years, give us the next breakthrough that happened.
So we decided we couldn't handle this thulium. It was too reactive. We had to use it in situ. We would just make it, generate it, not try to isolate it, and just use it. And when we tried to do a reaction with that before we could add the next reagent, it had reacted. And what we found out was that it was reducing nitrogen, which we thought was the inert atmosphere that we were working with. So the reason that we hadn't found anything for 3 years is we had made the assumption that nitrogen – was inert, and that's a good assumption for most things, but not for thulium too.
Well, we'll come back to that because nitrogen is, in fact, one of those beautiful molecules that has very special chemistry. But you're listening to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Bill Evans from California Irvine. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. A holy grail of obesity research is to find the genes and their products behind it. For a while, it looked like mutations in a gene called FTO was responsible.
But a new study reveals the FTO mutation is actually affecting another gene that does make someone more apt to be obese. It's called IRX3 and is quite a distance from the FTO gene.
What's also interesting is how the two interact. Genes have an area that control gene expression and segments that don't code called introns. Researchers saw that the mutated FTO intron wasn't affecting the FTO gene expression. Rather, it enhanced the expression of the distant IRX3 gene.
To test their theory that the IRX3 gene is an obesity gene, researchers engineered mice without it. These mice turned out to be much leaner than normal mice, even though they ate the same foods and were equally active. When they were fed a high-fat diet, they remained lean, while the normal mice doubled in weight.
These mice had smaller fat cells and more brown fat, which is healthier. We humans also carry brown fat, which generates body heat, while the less healthy white or yellow fat is stored around our waists and thighs. The mice with no IRX3 gene were also better able to process glucose, making them more resistant to diabetes.
These results were confirmed in humans when researchers studied brain samples from 153 people of European ancestry. Their FTO mutations were also associated with IRX3 expression and affected their obesity risk.
Scientists plan to study exactly how IRX3 gene expression affects other genes in order to develop new drugs that could one day be used to treat obesity.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back. This is Keith Pannell with Russ Chianelli and Bill Evans from the University of California, Irvine, and we're talking about rare earths, the lanthanides. And as you say, nitrogen sometimes does things. And I remember I was at the University of Sussex when they first found the molybdenum dinitrogen compounds. You know, and I remember we went to the pub. It wasn't my work. It was Tony Butcher and Tony Wedd. But yes. We went out for drinks and we came back at about probably 3, a little later than we normally would have come. And there was this beautiful crystals, yellow crystals, which turned out to be, you know, the first good molybdenum dinitrogen material. So surprises happen.
Right, right.
So you changed to argon, I suppose.
So
the inert atmosphere.
Yeah, we started working with argon, yes.
So what happened?
It's a very reactive molecule, and thulium is a very reactive ion, and so it destroys most of the solvents that we worked with. So it turns out the most interesting part of it is that it does reduce nitrogen, and it has advanced our knowledge of how you transform nitrogen. Nitrogen is transformed to ammonia, which provides the fertilizer that feeds the world. So a reduction in nitrogen is pretty important worldwide.
So the lanthanides actually been used in nitrogen fixation?
Not catalytically, but it's conceivable. So this thulium structure had a structure of nitrogen between two metals that had never been observed before. So in all the decades of work that started in Sussex with the Institute for Molecular Nitrogen Fixation.
Actually, it started in Toronto.
Okay.
With Bert Allen. He was the first one to make a dinitrogen complex
of
ruthenium.
Right.
No one believed him for years.
Right.
But anyway,
well,
sorry.
Listen, you inorganic chemist, I have a question about nitrogen fixation, okay?
Go for it.
My dear friend Ed Stiefel, who you may have known.
I know.
Okay.
Yeah, I knew.
Yeah. Worked with me and my group at Exxon, and we used to argue about nitrogenase constantly. And he was extracting the cofactor and trying to make it. And to my knowledge, the inorganic chemists have never made the cofactor X nitrogenase to work.
I agree. Yeah.
Why?
Well, I think we don't know well enough how to handle the extended structure. We know how to put atoms together to make molecules, and putting more structure around those molecules to control them the way nature does has just not been achieved. So we know how to make molecules. We know how to make materials, big things and small things, but in the middle is where we still need to learn.
Yeah, so for our audience, the cofactor is this piece with molybdenum and nitrogen and iron, I guess.
Yeah.
That you can pull out of the whole enzyme, and it doesn't work, and you can put it back in, and it works. And so I think what Bill is saying there is you need the rest of that enzyme to make the thing work.
Right, right.
Well, it's the same with hemoglobin. If you drag out the iron porphyrin part in the middle, it's not going to transport oxygen around your blood system.
Guys.
It's the big protein that sort of protects it. Anyway, let's go back. After you've now changed your environment, you put in the argon, then what did you decide next? How did you go about capitalizing?
Well, once we realized we could get thulium,
right.
I had a student who thought he could get the next most likely divalent ion, which was dysprosium. I thought this was a crazy idea, but he tried it and it worked. Yeah. And then Botchkareff went to the next one, neodymium, and we got 3. So when I started my work in lanthanides, we had 3 divalent ions. And within 3 years, we had 3 more. We doubled the number of oxidation states we were working with. And that's quite a remarkable thing in chemistry to be able to do that.
And what's also remarkable is that you've used the expression crazy 3 times.
Yeah, why did you think he was crazy for thinking that? What was it about the atom that...
That it was... It just... All the calculations suggested it was so reactive that it would destroy solvent and it would destroy anything you had.
Ah, so it's a theorist's fault.
Well, what solvents does it sort of handle? What solvents is it stable in? I mean, what is a good stable solvent for this area?
So it will destroy diethyl ether, but it's stable in THF, tetrahydrofuran, and dimethoxyethyl.
Okay, so well-known materials.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
And what's happened since is in exploring these three new metals, we found that we can make plus two chemistry from all the lanthanides, even if they don't have a plus two ion. And we don't understand how that works yet, but we're very excited about doing this now with all 14 metals instead of just six.
Tell me, is there much catalysis? I mean, well, I know there are. People are beginning to look at these lanthanides and say, good catalytic materials. Do you get involved with that?
We have done some. So it turns out neodymium, again, the one that's in the magnets, is one of the best materials for making synthetic rubber. And synthetic rubber can be used in high-performance tires for better mileage, but it's a little bit expensive. But neodymium is one of the best ones that makes synthetic rubber from isoprene, which is a dyeing.
The question I would have as a catalyst person, is it really a catalyst or is it a stoichiometric reaction?
No, it's a catalyst.
So it doesn't poison. It keeps going.
No, it's a catalyst. It's definitely a catalyst. And the other things that the lanthanides are very good in polymerizing are polymers that are biodegradable. There's a polymer you can make from waste from cheese manufacture. It's made from lactide. You can wring open the lactide and make polylactide, and it hydrolyzes back to lactic acid. But you make a polymer, and so it's used for sutures that go internally that you want to dissolve in the body and never have to go and get that suture out again after the internal suture.
You know, it's an interesting question because I remember back in my Exxon days when they were making biodegradable polymers. They really wanted to stay away from it because the EPA told them that they had to prove that every piece on its way to biodegradation was okay, not toxic.
Yeah.
And say, well, it's better to make something you can go and pick up.
Well, this one from lactic acid is very nice because acid is a natural product, so.
But we don't normally think of cheese as a waste. But anyway, that's a different discussion. Italians don't anyway, and French people.
I'd like to get your take on risk-taking.
Okay.
You start out a career, you're an assistant professor, and you've been told to be the best in the world. Everybody, I'm sure, tells you that, but it's not easy to be the best at anything.
Right.
Unless you find an area that's been sort of covered over with dust for centuries. But tell us, what do you see currently about new people coming into science? I mean, you're an established scientist, and one of the ideas of tenure, for example, is to sort of say, hey, go out and try something a little bigger than you've done before. I don't know if a lot of people actually do that so much, but I'd like your take on the whole concept of science and research and risk.
Yeah, I think it's very important for young people to do something very different. And when I went from boron to the lanthanides, I knew nothing about the lanthanides. I didn't know their names in order, in fact. Because of that, because I hadn't been trained as a traditional lanthanide chemist, I tried things that nobody else would have tried. And I think that's how science should be advanced. Right now, I think it's very popular for young people to begin working in areas very closely related to what they did in their previous work. And I don't think that's a good idea.
I
think they should take more risks, and I think they'll find things. But I don't know how to change that.
I mean, are you a mentor? In California, Irvine, I mean, you have a mentor program for new faculty.
Right.
And
right.
So you must have been a mentor to several assistant professors.
Right.
How do they react when you tell them, you know, if they've come from a lab where they've done osmium and they think, well, maybe I'll look at rhenium or something like that? You say, well,
we take care of that because we don't hire those people. So the ones we've hired recently have been ones who've proposed to take risks.
Okay.
And they've done very well.
You know, there's an old editorial that's quite old by Roald Hoffman. When he was asked,
okay,
how do you pick your students? And he said, I look for risk.
Yeah.
And the ones that figured out how to get straight A's by the formula, that's not the ones you want.
Yeah.
You want the one that has some riskiness in
right.
there. And he said that very clearly, and that's been my experience in research too.
There's so much still to be discovered in science and in chemistry that we don't need to try to make incremental advances. We can try some big questions, and that's what people should do, I think.
Well, do you think the funding agencies always recognize that and the peer reviewers? And there are issues here which make it very complicated to take a big risk.
So the problem is that the young investigators need to get funding
right.
and they need to get results quickly, and so an easier way to get quick results is to do something you're familiar with. So that's a problem.
How do we change that?
Well, I think you need to give some funding up front, and if they've gotten the job and they've done everything to get a job, they should be given money to go off on their own and see what they can do.
Don't they do that in Canada? I mean, each professor there gets a little bit of money each year from the
That's right. There's a broader distribution there, right? And there's, you can probably take more risks in Canada, but I don't know if that's being done.
That's worth actually pursuing.
Yeah.
But I mean, one of the things I see that I dislike intensely is when you find established faculty with groups of 25, 30 people. I mean, do you have those big groups in Irvine?
We have some, yeah. But I think you have to be really extraordinary to be able to interact well with a group that large.
Right.
And invariably, I think you interact intensively with the most active of that group, and that might be 5 out of the 20.
It's interesting. As we're recording this morning in the paper, there was an article about how Texas A&M is going to rate the professors on the bottom line. In other words, if you've got the most money, you're number one. If you've got no money, you're down there. And it's kind of a scary concept.
Well, I mean, the alternative, as I've got a good friend, Edward Teeking, he's a crystallographer, started in Adelaide and then moved to Singapore and then came to the U.S. and then moved back to Singapore or something like that. And they hired him in this last institution, and they said, well, we want 100 impact factor points every year, right? So this is slightly different, but an impact factor is if you publish in Journal A and you get 10 references a year for your paper, that's called 10 points.
Right.
So you've got to publish 10 papers in the top journal or 100 in some insignificant journal, but you've got to get your 100 points.
Yeah.
Do people talk about that in California at all? Or?
They do, and I tell them I think they're crazy.
Or how about the H factor?
Again, or the H factor. So
for our fans, the H factor is this National Academy rating system that
– The Hirsch number.
The Hirsch
anyway,
number.
But – You rail against this idea.
Well, the people that did cold fusion, which was wrong, got very high number of citations. And it turns out that somebody just published a crystallography paper in Acta Crystallographica, which is not a high-impact journal. But because everybody references that paper, now Acta Crystallographica is one of the highest-impact journals in the
– What was that paper?
Well, it was on how to do the crystallography, and everybody that does crystallographic experiment cites that paper.
I got a good friend in Puerto Rico. His name is John Soderquist.
Okay.
In fact, you know him because he was Boron and he worked
and
with H.C. Brown.
Too, yeah.
Yes. But his most cited paper is how to purify trimethylamine oxide.
Okay.
And you simply sublime it, gets rid of the water. And, you know, it's a note somewhere, but everybody cites this when they're talking about using trimethylamine oxide.
So people and administrators would like to have metrics to evaluate people, and they grab onto these things, but they're really not the important thing.
As I've looked at this risk question, which I agree with entirely in terms of researchers, it has something to do with real curiosity and love of science.
Yes.
Where that's first, not you know how many citations and so on, a second.
Right.
How can we encourage that? Because I tried to do that, and that's really amazing when you see students go off in the corner and do something that you didn't tell them to do. That's the best experience.
Yes. So in my group, I start my students with a starter project that's pretty conservative. Their dissertation project is more ambitious. But before they leave, I have them do an exploratory project. So they already have enough papers and results to get a PhD and to get a job, and I say, I want you to just go off the deep end, do something that you don't think maybe will work, and just get that experience before you leave my group.
I think we just about run out of time. Bill Evans, University of California, Irvine, it's been delightful having you here on Science Studio.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's been fun.
We'll do it again sometime, I hope.
Okay, good.
Thanks, Bill, very much for being here. Please return to Science Studio, and thanks to Norma Martinez, our producer.
And as always, when we talk chemistry, we must thank the Camille and Henry Dreyfus Fund for partial support of this program. And of course, we always thank the audience. Thank you for being there, and we'll be back again next week with another riveting program. Bye-bye.